I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 9th, 2018. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Bishop, Senator Coghill, Senator Stedman, and myself, Senator Giesel. Excused today are Senator Meyer and Senator von Imhoff. Thanks to Ann and Max, who are helping us out. Today we have three items on the agenda. First, we'll take up Senate Bill 86 from Senator Coghill. Then we'll have a first hearing on Senate Bill 166 from the administration. Welcome, Senator von Imhoff. I actually didn't think you were going to be here today, so glad you are. And thirdly, we will have an overview of the A-STAR project for the North Slope. So with that, we'll take up the first agenda item. Senate Bill 86 is sponsored by the Vice Chair of this committee, Senator Coghill. This bill authorizes the railroad to sell parcels of land without checking in with the legislature each time. This bill was first heard on April 7th of last year. At that time, public testimony was open, and it was left open. Today we have a proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 86. This has been publicly posted earlier this week for review by the public, along with documents enumerating the changes from the prior version. So, Senator Coghill, a motion.
Sure, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt for Senate Bill 86 the work order 30-LS0487 Juliet for our committee as a working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for purposes of discussion and ask both the committee staff and the sponsor staff to come forward and explain the changes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Resources Committee. I'm Mikey Yolopsos, and I serve as staff to Senator Giesel and to the Senate Resources Committee. Madam Chair, I will go over the explanation of changes, and Ms. Reneva Moss, who is the staff to the sponsor, Vice Chair Coghill, will explain the rationale for those changes. So, Madam Chair, there's a document in the committee packet entitled CS for Senate Bill 86, Explanation of Changes from Version A to Version J, or Version Alpha to Version Juliet. And there are three changes, Madam Chair. The first change is that a new Section 17 is added, which is a sunset provision that would take effect 3 years after the effective date of this legislation. And that in turn, Madam Chair, created, because of the legal drafting manual, conforming sections to that sunset provision, which now has created a new Section 2, a Section 4, a Section 5, a Section 7, a Section 9, a Section 11, and a Section 13. And Madam Chair, for the edification of the committee and the public, all those sections are conforming to the preceding sections that would be remunerated after the sunset provision would have taken effect. That takes it to the second change, Madam Chair. And because the sunset provision presumes a certain change, specifically repealing 4240, 485, 1, and 4, and then at the end of 3 years reinstating the language of those statutes, that required that language to be reinserted in 4240, 485, but now 1 and 4 were being remunerated to 3 and 5 specifically. And because of that, Madam Chair, there was a cross-reference unrelated to this legislation, I beg your pardon, that dealt with in Section 14, a particular reference to federal law under 4240.285. And so what this does is just further conforms to the sunset provision. The third change, Madam Chair, is language that introduces the first right of refusal. And both the prior version of the bill and the proposed CS repeal and rewrite Alaska Statute 4240.352. However, the proposed CS, version Juliet, adds language in Section 12, and that can be found on page 6, line 19, giving existing leaseholders to railroad land the first right of refusal when the railroad plans a permanent disposal of the land. With that, Madam Chair, that's the brief explanation of what the changes are, and I defer to Ms. Moss and to the sponsor of the legislation for the rationale.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill, sponsor of Senate Bill 86. Ikey has stated on page 6, line 19, we have inserted language that actually is in the existing statute today that offers the leaseholders the right of first refusal. Senator Coghill feels this is only fair that opportunity be available. Also, the three-year sunset is to give the legislature a chance to take a relook at how the railroad is managing their land and disposing of their land and investing the profits from the sale of the land.
Very good. Senator Coghill, any further comments?
Only that the timeliness of this is important. There are some real estate issues that are on the table now, as you'll probably hear from some public testimony. The ability to get some of these lands into private hands, knowing that private land in Alaska is rare and at a premium, this might be some good economic develop opportunity, and I think the railroad probably could do well with it.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? All right. Yes, Senator Simmons? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wilikowski.
Just a few questions. So, and it's been 10 months since we heard this bill, I think, Madam Chair, so I'm just kind of refreshing my memory a little bit. But can you just describe to me how the railroad got the land in the first place? Was that granted by the state at some point? And then I guess that leads to my next question, which is it constitutional for us to allow a separate entity to sell what I assume to be state land? And then who gets the proceeds of that? The sale.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, for one thing, we do have Bill O'Leary and John Cook on the phone that can answer that better, but the fact of the matter is the federal government transferred that land to the state, and it is state land. It belongs to a public agency, but it's still state land. The proceeds, if I remember correctly, go back to that public agency.
Senator Wilikowski, would you like those other folks to try to answer that?
Please.
Okay. Mr. O'Leary, did you hear Senator Wilikowski's question?
Madam Chair, yeah, this is Bill O'Leary from the Alaska Railroad. And, yes, I believe the answer was correct that the land was transferred from the federal government. It was actually purchased when the state purchased the railroad, as well as the the rolling stock and the other assets that came over, 36,000 acres of land came over with that sale, with that transfer. And as sale of land, the proceeds would remain with the Alaska Railroad. Now, the funds, we are intending to use those funds for additional real estate development, and that's something that, again, I think our board chair, John Cook, who is also on the line, would probably be interested in discussing if you wanted to go further into that.
Thank you, Mr. O'Leary. And Senator Wilikowski, I remember hearing recently about the federal government and a railroad act in the late 1800s that did appropriate land to our Alaska Railroad, and we can get more detail, but you had other questions, I think.
Yeah, thank you. So I guess just on the constitutionality of it, is it, and I assume you got some kind of legal opinion, but is it constitutional to, so it's essentially state land and we're allowing the separate corporation to sell that and then keep the assets? Is that, have you gotten the legal opinion on that? And then, and also I'm wondering, I didn't see it in the packet, but do you have a map? We usually, when we do these, a lot of times we do these things, we get maps that have a description of where all the land is. Do you have a map that you could get to us on where all the railroad land is?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I apologize. I probably should have distributed that. We did have maps last year, but I'll make sure you get those before Monday.
Senator Wilikowski, do you think Mr. Cook might be able to give you more information about the legality?
Sure, if he's
okay. He's on the line. Mr. Cook, would you like to respond to the legality or constitutionality of the railroad selling state land?
I cannot speak to the constitutionality that I would assume that, frankly, between our general counsel and Ledge Legal, that those entities, address that issue while drafting the bill. So, but I can't directly speak to that. I'm not an attorney, and I'm not familiar in that level of depth with the statutes.
All right, thank you. But it is true that the railroad has been historically disposing of land as they come to the legislature in the past.
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes, you are correct. There have been several disposals of land to DOT, other state agencies, other municipalities, including the Native Corporation over the years that have come forward to the legislature. So I would assume, even though they're limited in number, that the disposal of those lands, you know, was vetted at that time. So it has happened historically. You're correct.
Thank you. Senator Coghill, did you have a remark about this?
I just wanted to bring up that with the Alaska Housing and DOT, we've given corporations rights to work within those things. It is true that Alaska Housing gives a dividend based on some of those, but that's a real estate enterprise that they're into. Not so true with DOT, but we've allowed them the right to keep some of the proceeds of some of their land transfers. So I don't think that we're in trouble there. And when we first asked that question a year ago, that's kind of the answer we got back at this point.
Okay.
Further questions, Senator Wilikowski?
I do, yeah. So just maybe you can walk me through the process of selling, how the sale of land would go if this passed. Would there be an RFP process? Would it? I saw that there would have to be some sort of public notification, but is there some kind of assurance that somebody's not going to sell it to their uncle or their cousin for a sweetheart deal?
Madam Chair, John Cook is online to answer that
not
question.
Not that anyone would ever do that.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Cook, you're online to answer that type question. Did you hear it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a very good question by Senator Wilikowski. We are required to obtain fair market value for the disposals of any land that we will dispose of, and that requirement existed prior to this legislation, would still remain in effect. That is determined one of two ways, either through an appraisal of fair market value by an MII appraiser or a competitive bid process. So those are the two ways that you would ensure, along with public notice, that there's adequate notice to the public to review those transactions and that they are done at an arm's length fair market value valuation.
Good. Follow-up. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, and maybe you can point me to the section of the statute, because I'm just looking at page 6, section 12, and maybe it's not in here. Maybe it's – oh, there it is. Is it section 11? Party other than the state shall receive made at fair market value. Is that the section you're referring to, sir?
I'm trying to get there now. You're way ahead of me here, and we had some of this information yesterday. Let me see if I can pull that up. It would be 42-40.350, subsection D.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further follow-up, Senator Wilikowski?
Not this time.
All right. Senator Bishop, question?
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Moss, if you or somebody online could, on this addition we just put in on page 6, line 19, on the first right of refusal, is there a timeline that the first in line would have to try to put a deal together, or do we know, I just was curious.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I believe that is in their policy and procedures for sales, and John Cook could respond to that.
Great. Mr. Cook, did you hear the question from Senator Bishop?
Through the chair, yes, I did. Again, I can't tell you the exact amount of time that's there. I thought that was described somewhere in the statutes that regard or that discuss right of first refusal. It might be in 42-40.352 subsection B subsection 2, perhaps. But I, from a just a larger perspective, I can tell you that it is not going to be the policy or the intent of the board to ever sell land out from underneath an existing leaseholder. The only time I can see that happen, frankly, is where an existing leaseholder wishes to purchase, the land, and we've decided that it's in the best interest of the railroad to do so. So, I think there's certainly time provisions in there, but just from a procedural standpoint, we do not have any desire to sell land that we're getting rents from out underneath us. What we're trying to do is grow this endowment and grow the lease endowment through, being able to monetize lands that aren't earning us any current return, invest that back in the income-producing property, which produces an 8% return and fair market value. So, you know, our goal is not to get rid of income-producing customers.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
When property is sold now and it's got to be approved by the legislature, does that do the proceeds of that go back to the railroad, or is that discretionary as to where that money can go? For I don't know, whoever can answer that question.
Yes, Mr. Cook.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski. I think Bill O'Leary had said this earlier, but those proceeds would remain, you know, with the railroad, so they don't. They don't go to the general fund or back to the state. Those go, you know, they stay with the railroad. And again, our intention is to take those proceeds and reinvest them in that real estate, you know, portfolio to grow, you know, to grow our leased properties and increase the, you know, the return that we get from them on an annual basis.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
And maybe this was incorporated in your answer, but in the past, has that money always gone to the railroad? Has that always been has that always gone to the railroad? And is that subject to?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm only familiar with one instance that in my tenure on the board, the number of transactions is extremely limited. But I can tell you from the proceeds that we received, at least from one DOT sale to DOT that I can recall, we did, you know, retain those. We did receive those proceeds. That's the only instance of any cash that we received in my 9-plus years on the board. So the answer is yes, at least with the one transaction I'm familiar with.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Is that subject to legislative appropriation? So if there's a sale and you get $10 million, does that have to be appropriated by the legislature to the railroad or somewhere else? Or does that just automatically go to the railroad? And is that legal to do that?
Mr. Cook.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, again, I would assume that no, I mean, we're not, the railroad is not subject to the Executive Budget Act. And again, in the one instance that I had, you know, we had kept $1.5 million in proceeds from the sales of our property to DOT. Again, I have no reason to believe that we're not allowed to keep those funds, and I have no reason to believe that that's not the case.
Further questions? Senator Wilkowski.
On that point, I appreciate, I don't know if there's anybody from legal that's evaluated that. It's a recent Supreme Court case that addressed this issue of funds and appropriations, and it would seem to me that money's probably got to be appropriated now, but just be curious to get a legal opinion on that if we could.
Anything else, Senator Wilkowski?
No.
Okay. It is my intention to adopt the committee substitute, but hold this bill until Monday. And so I would ask Mr. O'Leary and Mr. Cook, you've heard some questions now from members of the committee, if you could dig into those answers. And I know Ms. Moss has been writing those down also. It'd be important to have those answered. We did, from my staff, receive a map of the railroad's lands. So that's helpful. That answers one of the first questions. So that's good. Any further questions at this time for the committee or the bill sponsor or any of the folks from the railroad? Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
On this map, I appreciate it. And just so I can understand this, and I'm just holding it up so the camera can see it. There's kind of a pinkish line. Is that, I assume that's all railroad land? It's a little bit difficult to tell. And it seems like it's just the corridor. Is there land outside of the railroad corridor that is owned by the railroad?
Ms. Moss.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, there are parcels outside of the corridor. And if you look at the red writing along the pink right-of-way, it'll tell you the area that the land is in and the total acreage that is in that site.
Madam Chair,
yes, Senator Coghill.
Senator Wilkowski, if you look at the Nenana section, for example, I can tell you they own a dock front there, and they lease it, and then there's an area where they have the railroad loops around so they can climb an incline. And they own all the land around that, and they lease some of it. So just to give you an idea, that many of them are either loading fronts or housing areas where, like, for example, at the park they had that railroad house that was a that ended up being a started off being a hotel. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just I'm just wondering the extent of the coordination that is occurring between the railroad or will occur. I guess one of the benefits of having the legislature involved is we can, in terms of future planning, and talk about running the gas pipeline down, and I assume it would run a similar course to a lot of this land, and I guess I just don't want to see the railroad have the free rein to go ahead and sell land that could possibly create problems for a gas line or other easements the state might want to retain. So I don't know what sort of interaction is planned in the future or what sort of protections we can put in place to make sure that the railroad's not getting crosswise with the state in terms of other easements we might seek for projects.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I know that the railroad currently works very closely with DOT, and there have been probably half a dozen land exchanges between DOT and the Alaska Railroad for realignment of the highway and realignment of the railroad. So they do work with other state agencies.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Well, and they work with them right now because they've got to come and get legislative approval, right? And if we pass this, then they no longer have to get legislative approval to sell for private lands. And I'm just wondering what sort of protections we can have in place for sales that might impact.
Through the chair, that is true. The legislature has been approving those land exchanges.
Thank you. Senator von Imhoff.
So thank you. I think just to sort of just add a little bit to the discussion, there's a sense of, I guess, evaluating all the components that go into a sale. On one hand, putting on the big hat, we have an AKLNG project, you're absolutely right. On the other hand, some of the land, I know there's near Chena Hot Spring, or not Chena Hot Springs, to Chena Pump Road, a housing development. I mean, those are the kind of things that they're just trying to take a look at and get money for the railroad. I would feel hesitant to say, well, just in case there's this AKLNG, hold off on the housing development for years. Those are the kind of evaluations that I think are fair, but at the same time, if the housing market is hot, it's only 3 years, let's let them, you know, try to get money for their operations and for their capital expansion or whatever else that they need. So, I mean, it's a risk-reward evaluation.
And, Madam Chair, I do believe that the legislature has already passed a statute that set out the right-of-way for that gas line.
That's true. Thank you very much, Ms. Moss. Senator Wilkowski.
No, creates a little bit of a policy dilemma, I guess. And I know in Anchorage, I don't represent the area. I think that's your area, Senator. Where the railroad does run, and I don't know the impacts, and I'm assuming the community is voiced in pretty strongly on this. And I guess I just want to I worry a little bit about the giving the railroad sort of free rein on this. It's probably, you know, it's a very valuable corridor. It's very valuable property. I just want to make sure that we're doing this in conjunction with local communities and with the state, and we are taking a little bit of that away, a lot of that away with this. I just want to make sure we're evaluating that and making sure we're not getting ourselves into something that's going to bite us later.
I appreciate your question, Senator Wilkowski, and certainly that's, I believe, part of the philosophy behind the three-year sunset. And, of course, we gave a lot of leeway to a gas project and now are somewhat restrained in our ability to interact with that project. So I understand your concerns. I believe that the railroad folks that are on the line have heard the concerns. If they could come back on Monday, when we will be taking public testimony on this, with some concrete legal discussions about the questions that you've asked, I think that'd be great. for the public, the map that the committee members have been given of the corridor and the property is going to be on basis, if it's not already, it's also on basis, I'm seeing here, that it actually is currently, so the public can also view it. So at this time, any other questions that you would like addressed by Monday when we hear this again? Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
I'll clarify. So my understanding is this only applies to land. The railroad couldn't sell the entire railroad to some private corporation, for example, or its individual assets. It's just land. Is it that assumption correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. All right. So if there are no further questions at this time, I'm going to remove my objection to the adoption of this committee substitute. Is there further objection to adopting the committee substitute? All right. Seeing none, the substitute is adopted then. It is my intent to bring this back on Monday. So folks that would like to testify on the bill, be aware that it will be heard on Monday. It will be the first thing on the agenda, so that will be at 3:30. So tune back in then and prepare your testimony. So we'll set this bill aside and take up the second topic on our agenda today. This will be the first hearing of Senate Bill 166. This is related to mining statements of labor. This is a bill from the administration, and it's being managed by the Department of Natural Resources. So this committee actually held an informational hearing on the subject of the mining claim process on January 22nd. We heard some great information, hopefully tuned us up for hearing this bill. So we're going to have a brief overview of the bill and a sectional analysis from the bill managers at DNR. So I welcome Deputy Commissioner Heidi Hansen and Mr. Ed King, Special Commissioner to the Commissioner of Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ed King, Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and the Deputy Commissioner will start with some opening remarks.
Wonderful.
Madam Chair and members of the Senate Resources Committee, SB 166 is an attempt to help the mining community solve an increasingly prevalent problem of the unintentional abandonment of mining claims. The administration submitted this bill as a way to begin the conversation to resolve this issue. We have no pride of authorship when it comes to the legislation, and our goal is simply to fix the problem. In this bill, we have provided one option to begin the dialogue, but we are happy to work with the committee and the public to find a result that is the best outcome for all the parties involved, including the state. Before we dive into the bill itself, I think it's prudent to note that the mining claim is structurally different than a lease agreement. A mining claim is a self-initiated right, which is perpetuated by the miner's actions. Failure to meet the legal requirements to maintain a claim results in the automatic termination of the claim by operation of law, not by departmental action. The department has little discretionary authority or leeway under the current statutory structure to, quote-unquote, forgive errors on affidavits or failure to pay rent. The rights themselves and the preservation of those rights fall to the claimant. Over the last few years, we've received numerous complaints that the current statutory requirements are too rigid and punitive, and in many regards, we agree. That is why we're here today, trying to find a way to help the industry solve this problem. In the face of budget cuts and staff reductions, we look for a solution that would decrease rather than increase DNR's administrative burden while also addressing the issues presented. The labor requirement itself is minimal, and the reality is that the holder of the mining claim is very likely to want to work their claim to generate value from their exclusive rights to the locatable minerals. A legal requirement to do that work is not necessary. Meanwhile, the requirement to pay rents already provides an additional economic incentive to do the same work. As we evaluated the options to address this issue, it became clear that a simple fix was not available. We considered a waiver system, but we realized that administering that program would require additional staff. We contemplated a grace period and required notification, but realized that too would require increased burden on staff. As we looked for ways to relieve the miner of uncertainty brought on by their actions, each alternative shifted workload to the department. In this fiscal environment, it didn't seem prudent or practical to request additional staff. And it seemed to the department that a repeal of the annual labor requirement would be a win-win, that is, a way to improve miners' tenure security without increasing departmental workload. Having initiated conversations with industry, it is clear that there are certainly other ways that we could address this annual labor issue, and we welcome those discussions. We decided to move forward with the solution presented today to begin the dialogue, and we look forward to working with you to find a workable solution.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I'll now walk through the sectional analysis and through the bill, if that's your preference. Before I get started, I would also like to say we have received a lot of feedback since this bill has been introduced, and we are preparing a, call it an FAQ, that we'll be presenting to you to supplement the materials probably early next week.
Very good.
And we'll roll in any questions that the committee has today into that FAQ as well.
Senator Bishop.
FAQ.
Frequently asked questions. Thank you, Senator. So, Madam Chair, Section 1 of the bill is a conforming change. Since we're removing the annual labor requirement throughout all of the state statutes, there's a reference to annual labor in Title 27, Chapter 10, that needed to be removed as well. So Section 1 is just a conforming change. Sections 2 and 3, Madam Chair, have generated a lot of interest. These sections surround this idea of a bona fide minor. This is a new term in our statutes that we're recommending. Basically, what we're saying is that somebody that is being given or taking the exclusive rights to the state's resources should have a responsibility to develop those resources. In many ways, the annual labor requirement was ensuring that that work was happening. And what we wanted to do is be very clear that our intention is that a holder of a mining claim still has that obligation to develop those resources. Now, we think in our minds, all of the miners that are out there today that are mining and doing their annual labor by their actions have already demonstrated that they are bona fide miners that are mining in good faith. There's not an intent to, you know, quote unquote, take away anyone's claims or anything like that by this language. And in reality, even without this language, we believe that it's implied, even if it is, if it isn't directly in statute. So the bona fide miner in Section 2 is added to the qualifications. In order to hold a mining claim, you must, in good faith, be somebody that intends to develop those resources. In Section 3, it goes into that.
Excuse me, Mr. King.
Yes.
Senator Wilkowski had a question at this point.
Okay, so what's the definition of a bona fide miner?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, in Section 3, the definition is added by subsection D. And a bona fide miner means an entity or person who seeks to acquires or holds exploration or mineral or mining rights under AS 3805-185 through AS 3805-275 in good faith for the purpose of mineral exploration and development and not for the prevention of mineral exploration and development.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
So how do you define, are you seeing a lot of instances where people are acquiring land not for the purpose of mineral exploration or development, or acquiring mining rights?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we don't go through that exercise today. It doesn't mean that there aren't people today that are holding mining claims without the intent of doing so, but in order for them to do that, they would have to be working the claim and paying their rents, and any resources that they did develop, they would have to pay royalties on. What we're suggesting is, or what we're trying to make very clear is that through this legislation, what we're not trying to do is open up a way for someone to get this new opportunity to withhold minerals from development.
Yes, follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Can you cite me any examples of lands where people are acquiring, holding exploration or mining rights not for the prevention of mineral exploration and development?
Senator Wilkowski, if I may, through the chair, I think more to the point, we're trying to encourage the development of mineral exploration and production. It's not necessarily that we're looking at the folks who may not be doing it, but the purpose of this language is to encourage the development of minerals.
So I take that as a no. You can't cite me a single example of someone who's not currently holding a lease, which is not a bona fide, which would not meet this definition.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that's correct. Under current statutes, just your actions themselves would require that you be bona fide by this definition. What we're suggesting is if we were to remove those requirements to do annual labor, we don't want to create an opportunity for someone to get those exclusive rights and deny those rights indefinitely to anyone else to develop them.
So, Mr. King, the annual labor report is kind of like a plan of development for an oil lease. It documents that you've actually done work and what that work was. But if you're going to remove that, you want to make sure there's something in place that says you still have to do some work, even though we're not asking you for that work written document. Am I close?
Madam Chair, that is our expectation. If we are to remove that requirement, we don't want it to be interpreted as the administration's position that now we're no longer requiring that work to be done. We honestly believe that the people that are out there claiming lands and working claims are going to continue to mine their claims. We're not suggesting that they're not doing that now or that they won't do that in the future. What we're trying to avoid is any kind of doubt that we do expect those claims to continue to be worked.
Okay, great. Do you want to continue this section?
So, Madam Chair, on Section 3 in subsection C of AS 380590, we're adding a new subsection, and this is intended to address that procedural, how we're going to administer this bona fide miner requirement. So the requirement itself, whenever a lease is applied for, the lease applicant would have to submit a affidavit that says they are, in fact, intending to work that claim. So we don't want to supply a lease to someone if they don't intend to extract the minerals. The mining claims don't have that requirement. The mining claims, because they are those self-initiated rights, it is assumed that they're bona fide unless we ask for their verification. So if the Department of Natural Resources for whatever reason, believes that there is an issue where a claimant may not be a bona fide miner, then we can send notification to that claimant and ask them for evidence that they are. That evidence is in the form of a recorded sworn statement, and if they supply that sworn statement, we take that as prima facie evidence that they are, in fact, bona fide.
Senator Wilikowski.
So, under current law, someone has to provide actually an affidavit that they're actually doing the work on the property. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator Wilkins.
And you're changing that so that someone actually doesn't have to do the work but says, well, I'm thinking about doing the work. And you think that's going to encourage more development and encourage more mining?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the issue of these unintentional abandonments create a lot of this uncertainty and consternation about whether a claim is still, in fact, under claim. And so what we're suggesting is that if we can clarify that, if we can remove one of those possible points of failure, then yes, it would encourage more investment. We don't believe that the only way that a miner is going to go out and mine as if we hit them with a stick. We think that the economic incentives themselves will drive that investment.
Senator Wilikowski.
Is this so? Right now, the rules are you've got to go out and spend a hunt. Is it how much time per year?
Senator Wilikowski, it's $100 per year.
Okay, so $100 per year.
$100 per year.
So, have you thought about extending the time that someone has to actually perform labor on their property from 1 year to 2 years? I just don't see how this encourages people to actually mine. I mean, if our goal is to get more development, and you're actually encouraging people to do less development, that doesn't seem like that seems counterintuitive to me.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I see your point, and I would say that the purpose of this bill isn't necessarily to encourage more development. It's to secure miners' tenure and to take away that uncertainty that they might be working a claim that has been invalidated and that someone else can take away from them by taking the actions of going out and staking that claim. So it creates a lot of uncertainty and therefore restricts investment. And to the point of the annual labor, it is $100 per year, but any additional labor above that $100 does roll forward, so you don't necessarily have to be out there every year. And if you can't get out to your claim and actually perform the labor, you can just send a check for $100. So it's not – the current environment isn't doing anything to necessarily encourage that investment. It's those miners' actions and their desires and their motivation for economic gain that's generating this resource development. We're not taking that away. We're trying to help secure that tenure to make them very comfortable to continue investing.
Senator Bishop.
Let's be clear on the $100. That's for one 40-acre quarter section claim. So when you start adding quarter sections or a quarter section, it gets real expensive real quick. So so there's more to the story. It's just not $100 for it could be. It could be one person out there that has one quarter section claim and it's $100. But if you go out there and you've got 20 quarter sections, then it's $400 for each quarter section. So it starts getting real money real quick.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. So, Mr. King, I'm trying to interpret what the goal was here. And the problem the committee is aware of is the question of top filing because a miner in their annual labor report made some error. The date was wrong. They signed in the wrong place. Some kind of clerical error. And so someone else, seeing that error, comes in and top files on them. They lose that claim. And so you're trying to fix that problem by removing the requirement for that paperwork. Is that close to what you're doing?
Madam Chair, just a point of clarification. When that erroneous affidavit is recorded, the abandonment already occurred. So upon recording, the claim is already abandoned. So it's not the action of someone else staking over that claim that invalidates the previous claim. And it's not a notification from the department that abandons that claim. It's the claimant's actions making that error is what abandoned that claim. And it's the I think that's a very important distinction. And I lost the rest of the question. Forgive me there.
Well, it actually wasn't a question. I'm just trying to drill down to the motivation. Mm-hmm. And there's my understanding there's also no grace period or redo or notification say, do you know that you made this mistake? And so, yeah, when the bad form is submitted, that's the end of it, and there's no grace period. And so I think you're trying to fix that too.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Under current statute, we don't have any leeway to forgive an error. The abandonment occurs when the action occurs. And it's not a decision that the department makes, and therefore it's not a decision that we can rescind. So there is no opportunity for us to provide a grace period under existing law. Now, if we remove the requirement for annual labor and the recording of those annual labor affidavits, the problem goes away. If we don't want to go that far, I know a lot of people feel like, you know, the straight repeal of the annual labor is kind of like taking a sledgehammer to a thumbtack. But if we wanted to fix the problem by doing a grace period like that, that is another option that we can entertain, and we can work with the committee to figure out what those amendments would look like. In doing that, though, one of the goals that we had in providing this legislation was not to increase the state budget. And what we're worried about is if we relax that requirement, provide that grace period, it puts work onto the department, then that might require additional staffing resources.
Understood. Senator Von Imhoff, did you have a question?
Well, Senator Giesel, I think that was exactly what my question was, the grace period. Is there any way, because it seems to me that a grace period may then alleviate some of Senator Wilikowski's concerns, and maybe a 60-day grace period, we're not talking 6 months, but maybe 60 days may make sense. And if that's the case, legitimately see how many claims might be in error in the past. Okay, 5, 50, how much is that extra staff time? You know, I don't know. Maybe a grace period is just the easy, it's a little hammer on the little thumbtack.
Madam Chair, I guess the point that I would make, the because the abandonment occurs when the error occurs, it might have occurred 10 years ago. And so if you put a 2-year or 2-month grace period onto something that happened 10 years ago, that grace period is also expired. So unless you attach the grace period to the notification that the abandonment has occurred, then you can have an opportunity to cure that. But then that requires the department to provide that notification before the cure period is eligible. And if we don't have the staff to go through all of the affidavits and check for errors and provide those notifications, then those affidavits aren't really doing anything at all. And the question is, why are we even doing this?
Did you have a follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff?
I thought that the paperwork was annual. So if they did something 10 years ago, you would have caught it by then. Okay, well, you
they
know,
answered no to that.
Yes, not necessarily.
For folks online, that was a no.
You know, I'm going to stop my round of questioning and because I clearly am not understanding what's going on.
Senator Wilikowski.
I had the same confusion, actually. It's like, how could somebody be delinquent or abandon their claim 10 years ago and still be paying their claim? But anyway, my question is, how many mining claims are there in Alaska and how many are abandoned each year?
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Wilikowski, there are about 35,000 mining claims today, and I will have to get you the answer on how many are abandoned, but the top of my head is somewhere between 5 and 10% per year. But I'll get an answer for you.
And Senator Wilikowski. So
that's a few thousand per year abandoned. And, I mean, I'm just curious where this is coming from. Like, where are people... coming to you because they're angry that they didn't work on their project, their mine, and it was abandoned, and someone else raced in. I mean, is that happening? Are people, you know, looking at the coming down and checking the recording records, and the day after somebody doesn't file their affidavit on time, they're going in and taking over the claim? I mean, what's the origin of this problem?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, and let me make that one correction before I answer your question. The number, the 5 or 10% that are abandoned, those are known abandonments. So it's possible that there are errors on affidavits that have never been checked and noticed, and they can be sitting in error for many years before it's realized that error had occurred, and therefore that abandonment had occurred. It could be several years ago. To answer the other question on the impetus of this particular effort, yes, there are people that are going out finding errors on affidavits and then overstaking that claim and accusing the senior claimant of being in default or having abandoned their claim and claiming rightful ownership of that claim. And that creates a property rights issue that needs to be settled and ultimately in civil court. And we've, you know, when those kinds of issues have occurred, you know, they do bring that to our attention. They want us as the commissioner's office to do something about it, and we simply don't have any tools to do anything about it.
Yes, Deputy Commissioner Hansen.
Senator Giesel, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, in addition to that, there are a number of people who have come to DNR to express their concern about when they believe that their claims are abandoned, then they have to go back and restake, and that can be, depending on the size of your claims or the number of your claims, that can be very costly as well. And so this is not only curing the problem that my colleague just mentioned, but it also cures that problem.
And Madam Chair, I'm sure some of your committee members have many constituents that have brought these issues to them as well.
Many, yes, I've heard them myself. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think I will be eager to get your frequently asked questions page, and I think that if you could kind of put it in layman's terms and start from the beginning, as in why are you bringing this up, what are the concerns that you're trying to address, if you remove the requirements for the abandonment claim documents, I think, or what is it you're doing, and then what are the, consequences, maybe, or what the actions you will fix, because I'm not following it.
We would be happy to do that, Senator Von Inhofe, through
you.
The chair.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Can I just... with the chair's leeway, could I just give a little bit of a historical perspective maybe to help?
That would be welcome.
maybe give Senator Wilikowski maybe just and Senator Von Hamel maybe a little bit clearer picture why this discussion is taking place today. As an example, and I won't mention names or talk about mining districts, but I have files in my office from people that have been on a state claim for 10 years. And through a error on recording the affidavit of annual labor, they were sent an abandonment notice and done, gone. So they've been out there for 10 years going cross country, rough trails. You know, I don't know how much they're spending. I know what I spend a year, but I don't know what they're spending a year. And it's, but it's a lot of investment. But at the, in the meantime, there was somebody top filed over the top of them. And 10 years worth of effort, one mistake, done, gone. And the top filer now has the ground. So that's just one. There's more than one. So that's what I think the department's trying to do, what we're all maybe trying to find a solution. I'm not saying this is the solution. I think the Deputy Commissioner made a very eloquent opening statement to that effect. And hopefully we can find a solution, because personally I think it's wrong to have 20 years or 10 years worth of effort and capital just evaporate. So anyway,
thank you, Senator Bishop. Let's keep going through the sectional, and we're not going to be moving this bill today. In fact, we aren't even going to open public testimony. I'm going to let folks kind of digest it and listen to the sectional, and we'll hear more later. But if you continue the sectional, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for the record, the sections 2 and 3 with regard to the bona fide minor, the rest of the bill survives without those provisions if they are creating a lot of problems. Section 4, Madam Chair, is just a conforming amendment, conforming change. It removes the reference to annual labor elsewhere in statute. Section 5 is one that we need to spend a little bit time on. This is the increase in the rental annual rental payments. And, Madam Chair, if I can direct the committee members to a piece of a supplemental materials document labeled Fiscal Analysis for Senate Bill 166. I can walk through that in as much detail as you like.
Great.
The if everyone is following along, the first box of that fiscal analysis is the lost revenues. These are the three revenue sources associated with the annual labor. If the annual labor were to go away, we would lose these revenues. $328,000 in payments that we received in lieu of annual labor. $113,000 worth of recording fees, as these claimants all must file those affidavits every year, and the $143 in penalties associated with curing annual labor. Those numbers all come from fiscal year 17. So a total of $584,000 of revenue that the state is currently generating that would be lost if this annual labor requirement were to be abandoned or repealed. So we have a total dollar figure. The next thing we need to do is have a total units of total units to divide dollars per unit. So the second box is because we have the different sizes of claims, we're trying to create one unit of measure. So the first is the 21,000 and some change 160 acre quarter claims. So each of those claims have four 40 acre claims within them. So multiplying the 21,000 by four is 85,000 equivalent claims. And then moving to the next line, which is labeled line 8, there are 57,975 acres under lease. Each of those leases, if we were going to convert them to 48-acre claims, would have 40 acres in them. So dividing that number by 40 gives you that 1,449 equivalent claims. And then finally, we have 13,294 actual 40-acre claims for a total of just under 100,000 40-acre equivalent claims. So dividing the total revenue by the total number of 40-acre equivalent claims gives us $5.85 per unit. The difference being, Madam Chair, that the current revenues are that are generated are all 100% general fund revenues. However, rental payments require contributions to the permanent fund as well as to the public school trust fund. So if we want to be general fund break even, we need to divide that 585 by that 49.5% to get to $11.82 per unit. Moving to the second page, Madam Chair, because of the provision in the statute, these 40-acre claim equivalent, these 40-acre claims all round to the nearest $5. So I rounded that down from that $11.84 to that $10. So multiplying $10 and $10 being less than 11 and something is going to be a shortfall. So we're generating just under $1 million in total revenues. Of those, 49.5 go to the general fund. We're losing $584,000 of general funds, leaving a net loss of just about $90,000 of general funds. However, we are getting additional revenues now in the form of the rest of those revenues going to the permanent fund and the public school trust fund. So there would be just short of $500,000 per year going to the permanent funds and another $5,000 going to the public school trust fund. So the total net change to the state is roughly $414,000 per year. Of that, a majority of it is restricted, and the balance being to the general fund. Turning to the last page, Madam Chair, is the actual change in the statute, and I think this is important to point out. The rental amount that is in current law and in Section 5 of the bill, you'll see that you're on page 3, line 29, you'll see on the far right-hand column, you're going from $20 to $50. And when people look at that, they say, okay, that looks like more than double. That's 2.5 times. That's a big increase. So it's important to point out that the numbers that are in statute are the numbers that were put in place in 1989. However, what the miners actually pay today is adjusted for inflation every 10 years. So what the miners are actually paying today for that same 0 to 5 year old 40-acre claim is $35, not $20. And here we are in 2018. The last time that these were inflation adjusted was 2009. So we're up against having another inflation adjustment next year anyhow. So applying that inflation adjustment to get us to today brings you to these numbers that are on the fifth line of that box on the third page of that fiscal analysis. So what I'm saying very clearly, Madam Chair, is if this bill were not to pass, what the miners would be paying today is that $40, that $85, and that $200. So the correct way to look at what the rental increase that's brought on by this bill is to see what we're recommending against that baseline. And you'll see that $10 increment that we talked about before.
Thank you for that explanation. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. King, I don't have it in front of me, but the 10-year CPI adjusted for inflation increment that's built into the statute, that's still at the discretion of the commissioner whether he wants to accept that or not. Is that accurate, or am I misquoting?
Yes, Senator Bishop, it is, through the chair, it is updated every 10 years by regulation. So to the extent that the commissioner has the discretionary authority to implement a regulation, you might be correct, but I would have to defer to a lawyer to answer that question more accurately. We do have one online if you'd like to ask her.
If it's the chair's prerogative, that could be in the FAQ sheet.
That sounds great. Any other questions? Senator Wilikowski.
So what are the requirements on federal property and does this bill affect those claims?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we did talk to BLM and make sure that what we're doing does not affect the federal claimants. There are state requirements that do govern federal claims, but a federal claim must also follow federal law. That's basically what our state law says. Removing, we thought that it made sense because we were removing the annual labor requirement from state law that we just simply remove it everywhere in state law. But even if we, if it is creating a problem, there's no requirement that we repeal the Title 27 references to annual labor. It wouldn't change the rest of the bill at all.
Senator Wilkowski.
But what, do you know what the requirements are on federal land to establish and keep a mining claim?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski. Through the chair, the federal law is still very much the General Mining Act of 1872 that governs, and basically all that is required is an annual work assessment that is, I believe, also $100 per 40 acres.
So follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
So our system is, would you say, identical or very similar to the federal system currently?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, prior to 1989, it was. So at statehood, we did adopt the federal law and the federal system, which required just the annual work assessment. However, in 1989, the Supreme Court ruled against the state and started requiring that the state also impose annual rental payments and royalty payments, which don't exist on federal claims. And so now, generally, the debate was always, do we want a location system like the federal government has, or do we want a leasing system that requires rents and royalties? Right now, we have both. So what we're suggesting is that we remove that annual labor requirement that is really kind of unnecessary in our current environment.
All right. I'll let you proceed.
So, Madam Chair, we have received many questions about that Section 5, and I hope that my answer was adequate, and that fiscal analysis is on the record and available on basis, and happy to continue to discussing that with the committee at any time.
Thank you.
Moving on to Section 6. Section 6 is that inflation adjustment that we were talking about. Madam Chair, because we're making an adjustment to the rental payments, it makes sense to go ahead and inflation adjust the statutory requirements into today's dollars. So what Section 6 is doing is rebasing the inflation index to the 2018 time frame. So rather than referencing the 1989 time frame that the original rental requirements were put into law, we're now referencing the year that we're updating them. And so the next rental inflation adjustment would happen 10 years from now.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, Section 7 is simply maintaining a definition that would otherwise be lost by repeal. So the definitions section of the annual labor chapter are found in 3805-242, and we're the only, because most of those definitions are related to things associated with annual labor, the only surviving definition that needs to be maintained is this MTRSC system definition, that Meridian Township Range Section Claim section. So we're just pulling that definition out of 242, which is being repealed, and moving it into 211. Madam Chair, Section 8 is the removing those repealed statutes from the abandonment provision in 3805-265, so just conforming changes. Madam Chair, Section 9 is a new subsection that we're adding to the abandonment subsection C, and this is intended to help with this issue that even though we're resolving the issue from the date of this effective date moving forward, we still have this issue of potential errors on affidavits that are in existing files, and we've been trying to figure out how we can best provide that security to those miners. But because we don't have the real discretion to just grant them immunity, we were trying to figure out what's the best way to allow those cures to happen, to occur. What we decided to do was to just simply waive the penalty associated with making those curing those abandoned claims. So your 265 already allows you to make to cure an abandoned claim that is the result of, you know, an error and an essential fact. But when you do that, it requires that you pay a penalty. So this section is allowing us to waive that penalty.
Senator Bishop.
And the timeline on that is in Section 9 to cure that?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, there is not actually a time defined in the statute to cure an abandonment. There is, so you really have indefinite time to cure an abandonment.
So in Section 9, as written here.
Does it have a timeline? Senator, let me make sure that there's not something slipped in there that I don't know about. There's no timeline provided.
And how far back in time?
It's indefinite, Senator.
Okay. I just want to make sure that's clear and on the record. Thank you.
Senator, Madam Chair, the only caveat that I would give is that the cure provision doesn't apply whenever there is a competing interest. So if you do have two people that are both asserting their rights to the claim, then that cure can't happen, and that needs to be settled before we can progress on who... You know, somebody has to rule on who has the property rights. So therefore, that cure can't happen until that clarification is made.
So you're saying if the property or the lease has been top filed on, it goes into civil litigation. Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Madam Chair, Section 10 repeals the annual labor requirement. This is the repealer section. It requires everything associated with the annual labor. I've attached another document, a separate document, that is the repealed statutes, the full text of all of those repealed statutes, in case, you know, for your reference. Section 11 is transitional language, and we inserted this because it might create confusion if we removed the requirement for annual labor in the middle of an annual labor year. So then you would have a requirement for part of the year and then not part of the year, and it might create problems. So basically what this is doing is creating an effective date of September 1st and creating transition language.
Thank you very much. Senator Wilkowski.
I want to get on the record. Section 10, you're repealing a number of different statutes, and just for the record, is it fair to assume those are all conforming changes and nothing else?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. This is the actual annual labor requirement and then all of the statutes surrounding the enforcement of that annual labor requirement.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Section 12 is a provision that clarifies the timing at which the commissioner can calculate the changes of rentals in each year, and this provision is just making it very clear that the next inflation adjustment will happen in the year 2028. Section 13 authorizes the department to adopt regulations and implement changes that are made by this act, and Section 14 authorizes the department to amend existing leases to conform with statutory changes in this bill. Madam Chair, the reason that's important is because a lease, unlike a claim, is an actual contract, and those leases have contract terms. The legislature can't just strike a term of a contract, so this is allowing us to take those terms out of the lease to conform with the statutory changes that this bill would be making. Madam Chair, Section 15 provides for an immediate effective date for Section 13. And Section 16 provides for the effective date of September 2nd. That's the first day of the next annual labor year. And those are that is the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. King. Further questions at this time? I don't see any. So it is my intention we're going to set this bill aside. We will have stakeholder testimony scheduled, and I'm looking at the last half of next week for that, and that would be the next time this bill would be before us. So, again, we'll probably be hearing from stakeholders and getting lots of testimony. Thank you very much, Mr. King and Deputy Commissioner Hansen, for the briefing on the bill.
Thank you, Senator.
So we'll set that aside, and we'll go on to our final agenda item, which is hearing about the Arctic Strategic Transportation and Resources Project, otherwise known as the A-STAR Project. This would deal with road infrastructure on the North Slope. It is becoming increasingly challenging to put in ice roads there due to some warming, and those roads are becoming more unreliable. This looks at the possibility of actually putting in some gravel roads, hopefully. And so thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for coming to brief us on the project DNR has jurisdiction over.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair Giesel. So as you noted, the A-STAR project is a partnership with the North Slope Borough and in collaboration with area communities and other stakeholders. As the slide here says, we're seeking to identify, evaluate, and advance community infrastructure. In 2017 supplemental, $7.3 million was set aside for this project, and A-STAR is we're really excited about the prospects of what A-STAR might be able to bring to the North Slope Borough. A-STAR is operating under a formal partnership agreement that established a working relationship and open dialogue between DNR and the North Slope Borough. And this partnership will help ensure the needs of the people and the communities within the borough are reflected in A-STAR's outcomes. So this is really a collaborative effort. This is not DNR trying to find out what the best ideas are for development up there. Just as a bit of background, the A-STAR participating state agencies are obviously DNR, Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Within DNR, we've got the Office of Project Management and Permitting, which is providing management and coordination for the project, and also the contractors, which we'll talk about a little bit more later. Division of Mining, Land, and Water, its Resource Assessment Development section is providing planning and website content. The Support Services Division within DNR is providing GIS and data processing, as well as some website design and management. The Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation is providing some graphic support with regard to the interpretation and education component of the Parks Division. And then obviously the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, as well as the Division of Oil and Gas, will be providing subject matter expertise associated with resource industry operations and available data. We're also working with Health and Social Services to provide a baseline of health, the baseline health summary report for the North Slope Borough. We're going to be looking to identify and explain health data gaps and potential means to fill those gaps. Potential health connectivity opportunities may include advancing telemedicine, which would require broadband. And so these are the kinds of connectivity initiatives we might be looking to work with Health and Social Services to do. With regard to the Department of Commerce, we've got discussions underway to engage multiple staff to focus on the regional funding opportunities, community resilience and adaptation, and other community resources. One of the opportunities for A-STAR could be opportunities for leadership and capacity building within the region. So we're excited about the prospects there. And then obviously the team is working closely with the Department of Transportation to enhance the overall project outcomes and to minimize any duplication that might be a result without better coordination. So we're really working closely with DOT to make sure that our efforts don't either get crosswise with or duplicate those efforts that DOT is already undertaking.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I just want to comment, you know, some folks might think it odd that you're collaborating with the Department of Health and Social Services, but our Department of Natural Resources led the way in considering social and health impacts on development of our resources. Several years past, they started doing that and kind of led the way nationally in getting that social license, so to speak. The other thing that is interesting, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, I know the Northwest Territories just finished a road to their Arctic coast, and it means $12,000 a year of savings for each village occupant along that road in decreased cost of living.
Absolutely.
So it's okay. A huge impact.
Thank you for those comments, and we absolutely agree, and thank you for your support in understanding those concepts. We really appreciate it.
So the desired outcomes for the A-STAR project, as I mentioned, is increased cultural connectivity, reduction in cost of living, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, the decreased rehabilitation costs for the MPRA legacy wells, more efficient development of natural resources, and increased economic activity in terms of jobs and whatnot. I would like to just point out that this project, as I mentioned earlier, it covers the entire North Slope borough, which, just for everyone's reference, goes down to the Anaktuvik Pass. That's sort of the furthest south that this project will be looking to cover. So with regard to the cumulative benefits, as I may have stated earlier, this project, A-STAR, is really looking to bring and provide the greatest cumulative benefits, which is why it's so important to work so closely with the North Slope Borough, the people, and the communities in the region. We're identifying cumulative benefits for the specific infrastructure, as I mentioned before, and this collaborative effort will really help inform state and local discussions with federal agencies as well on any sort of development that they might be working on. For points of reference, some of the transportation corridor routing will be developed with the communities that might include seasonal ice and snow and year-round gravel roads, trail identification and maintenance, utilities such as opportunities for natural gas pipelines, power lines, or renewable sources, fiber optic networks for high-speed data connection, and port barge shipping, marine, and aviation facilities. Again, we're just going in with an open mind. None of these are sort of pre-designed or imagined.
Deputy Commissioner, how many miles of road do you envision in this project? Any idea?
I don't personally have an idea. I'm happy to go back and see if we have a sense of that. If Jen Adelman is on the phone, she might have a sense of what is being contemplated, but I don't know that we've gotten that far, Madam Chair.
I don't see her online, but that's fine. You can get back to us, and I'm certain it's an incremental process.
Absolutely. I mean, this is just the beginning of the analysis, so I don't know that we've gone in with any sort of preconceived notion.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So,
Senator Wilkowski had a question also.
Yeah, thank you. Is there a plan in place to finance these developments, and how are we going to pay for them?
So A-STAR is actually, that's part of the slide here. We're assessing the sources of funding as part of this project. The A-STAR money will not actually build the project. It's just used for the purposes of finding the resources and determining what would make the most sense.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I mean, is this part of the state's long-range transportation plan developed by the Alaska DOT and approved by the federal DOT?
No, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this is specifically a resource development analysis and sort of how to increase the connectivity. And as I said, it's not just roads. It's all sorts of different kinds of connectivity to enhance and enable development in the North Slope Borough.
Good. Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, just from experience, I've seen roads go anywhere from $1 million a mile to $20+ million a mile. I mean, is that the sense that you're getting? And you thinking GO bonds or federal funds or general funds? I mean, do you have any sense how this would be paid for?
If I could get back to you, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that would be great. Thank you.
I did want to let you know also, Deputy Commissioner, that DJ Fauske is on the line from the North Slope Borough if you felt at any time he might be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll try to get back to you after this, if that's okay.
That's great.
Okay. So one thing that I would like to point out is there is a proof of concept underway right now. The A-STAR team is coordinating with the North Slope Borough on a pilot project. And this pilot project includes the participation in pre-application meetings and permitting follow-up, as well as assistance from our OPUMP office coordinators. The borough submitted a number of applications to the
to state and federal agencies for permits to connect through community winter access trails some of the villages in the North Slope Borough, and we're hoping that this proof of concept project will be very enlightening in terms of what's possible on the larger scale with A-STAR. The proof of concept project we anticipate will provide valuable data collection opportunities, including learning about how many and why people utilize transportation opportunities. For example, if it's viable to use these transportation corridors as an alternative to flying. Certainly air freight and barge hauling or commercial carriers, it would be good to be able to analyze sort of the various capacities and what those would mean for the community and what, as you say, the economics and socioeconomic output would be under those different circumstances. This proof of concept project would also allow and provide for regulatory expertise for future projects. These projects are really complex sometimes in terms of permits, and when you're looking at projects that require local, state, and federal permitting processes, this will allow us to look at multiple uses by multiple users in the MPRA and sort of benefit from those experiences. So that's a definite plus in terms of using this as a springboard to future development of projects through the A-STAR program. The state and federal permitting processes that are currently underway involve multiple proposed routes for activity of organized caravanning of personal vehicles of local residents on the snow roads, a route hauling fuel between Utqiagvik,
formerly known as Barrow,
and Atkasuk has been permitted, and the permitting for the new activity for that caravanning route is currently underway. I mean, this is a really interesting sort of ability for us to look at sort of what are the benefits of the caravanning. Caravanning is on a snow road, though, as opposed to an ice road, and so some of the things that we'll be looking at is the benefit of ice roads versus snow roads, and what would be the mixture of those two different kinds of access opportunities. The ice roads are necessary for heavier equipment to be hauled in, so if you had a drilling rig, you'd need an ice road for that, versus with this caravanning circumstance and permitting opportunity, that's just a snow road. So these are kind of some of the things that we are going to be able to glean from this proof of concept project.
Deputy Commissioner, do you know the difference in cost for the construction of an ice road per mile versus a snow road?
Can I get back to you, Senator Giesel?
Sure.
Okay.
Senator, is Don Perrin happen to be on?
No, I don't. Wait a second. He was on the other. Don Perrin was on. Don, are you still on the line?
This is Don Perrin. Madam Chair, I am on. And
great.
I have Jen Alderman with me and Jason Bergerson with the borough to answer your questions.
All right, great. So my question was the difference in the cost per mile for an ice road and a snow road.
Madam Chair, I would defer to Jason with the North Slope Borough to respond to that question, and we can also get back to you with more accurate data, if that's permissible.
Sure, that would be fine.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
I have an estimate at this time, but we'll provide that to you.
Great, thank you. Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
Ma'am, just I'd like to add one more to your when we talk about ice roads, are we talking ice roads for light vehicle traffic and then a cost for an ice road to move a drill rig?
Right. I think the Deputy Commissioner was distinguishing the snow road being the lighter load versus the ice road being the heavy industrial.
That's correct, Senator Giesel. That's what I said. But I suppose that you don't have to preclude lighter vehicles from being on an ice road. We'll get back to you with the various scenarios, if that's okay.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. So on the public input process, is that a local input process? Does DNR have any plans to ensure statewide public process in how these are developed?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, may I ask that Don Perrin respond to your question?
Sure. Mr. Perrin.
Yes, Senator, through the chair, if I understood your question, is there going to be a state permit required for the snow road project?
Yeah, I'm just curious about what kind of public process there would be if you're envisioning a local process or a statewide process where people all across the state could provide input.
Yes, through the chair, Senator, there is a public comment portion of the DNR DMLW state permits for tundra travel. And that's currently underway.
And that's statewide hearings in Fairbanks, Anchorage, I assume?
Local, state, and BLM.
Thank you.
Permits are required. If I could, Senator, I'd like to have the North Slope Borough Jason Ferguson to expound upon that a little bit.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, through the chair.
Thank you. Madam Chair, yes, this is Jason Bergerson for the record. At the local level, when we began the permitting process, we put our permits, the North Slope Borough permits, out for a 20-day public comment period. When we submitted our permits to Mining, Land, and Water, they got publicly noticed, as did our permits with BLM.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bergenson. Great. I'll let you continue, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. So some of the 2018 work highlights, A-STAR is using Alaska-based contractors hired to provide project management support, data analysis management, GIS analysis, stakeholder outreach and coordination, and as we mentioned earlier, economics and socioeconomics. What we're talking about there is things such as infrastructure project cost comparisons and analysis, assessment of project abilities, quality of life outcomes for residents, and those kinds of things that we discussed earlier. After the competitive bidding process and protest period, ASRC Energy Services Alaska, also known as AES Inc., and Resource Data Inc. were selected. Contract negotiations are underway as we speak. Just as point of background, we did receive 23 proposals and reviewed the evaluation team reviewed all of those. And we issued a notice of intent to award on January 5th. The mandatory protest period ended on the 16th, and there were no protests. The fact that we received 23 proposals, though, I think demonstrates that there's a lot of interest in what's going on here. And so AES and Resource Data will be competing for task orders on the data analysis and the management and GIS analysis and integration work going forward. Continuing on with the construction material survey, one of the crucial pieces of planning for infrastructure, obviously, is understanding the material sources in the region. We mentioned some of the work that DGGS would be doing for us in that regard, as well as the Division of Oil and Gas. As we've got here, the information on construction materials is scarce. The survey will be state-led. This will include regional and local partnerships, obviously, but it will be led by the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And the work will include the office data compilation, limited field investigations in 2018 and 2019, and any sort of subsequent publication of maps and reports. I do want to underscore the point, though, that we will be utilizing existing information to the greatest extent that we can. We will not be going out and creating new information or building new capacity, only if we need to at some point.
Did you have a question, Senator Bishop?
Just a comment. You know, it might be worthy to get in the archives at NARL and Utiavik and to see what's in the archives, because the Navy was spent a lot of time in, up there for years and years and years, and so there could be some good information in there.
Good point.
Thank you, Senator Bishop, through the chair.
All right, on to the budget.
The budget, yes. So, as you can see here, we've got 2018, 2019, and 2020. As I started off by saying, the initial pot of money was $7.3 million. We anticipate 2018 burning about $2.5 million of that. The first contract term is through June 30th of 2019. As you see, The contract services are obviously the big sort of ticket item here. And we will have a renewal option in 2020. Renewal option will expire in June 30th of 2020. So we have an ability to sort of – can I just retract my statement and just leave it there? Thank you, Senator Giesel. The contracts and personal services are the bulk of the expenditures, as I mentioned, and I would like to point out that DNR travel is also very high, and the reason for that is not only the face-to-face interaction with folks in the communities, and we all know that that's very expensive, but that also covers the very high costs of helicopter use that DGGS may need to rely on and leverage. I think that that's it. You'll see that there was one error that we caught and we wanted to just flag for you. On your slide here, you've got 2019 and 2020 under the computer and supplies costs being $14,000. And in fact, in 2019, we anticipate those to be $11,000, and in 2020, we anticipate those to be $8,000. So I just wanted to flag that error for you.
Thank you very much. Senator von Imhoff has some questions.
Thank you. So at the end of 2020, what are your deliverables? And what do you hope to have in hand at the end? And in essence, what are we going to get for $7.3 million? Are we going to have a plan, a report, permits, roads built?
Senator von Imhoff, through the chair, I'd appreciate it if it'd be okay for Don Perrin to answer that question.
Absolutely. Mr. Perrin?
Yes, Senator, I am also through the chair. I would like to ask Jen Edelman, our project manager, to respond to that question with the chair's permission.
That would be great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
This is Jennifer Edelman. I'm the lead ASTAR coordinator with DNR in the Office of Project Management and Permitting. Senator von Imhoff, through the chair. There's a variety of end products that we anticipate. One is certainly the construction materials survey. We may have an opportunity to do multiple areas over the course of the three-year project. We also will have the health baseline report that the Department of Health and Social Services is working on. And we will also have a strategic planning document that will include the process by which we took throughout ASTAR and the resulting suite of materials within the plan would include identifying projects that have both local and statewide support for the area that we heard about from locals and folks statewide through our scoping efforts. And we will be analyzing those proposed projects in order to determine which ones, either through connectivity as a suite of projects or individual projects, will bring the greatest cumulative benefit to the area. Those projects that demonstrate that greatest benefit will then be advanced and assessed for a variety of things, including funding sources, project sponsors, identifying obstacles and challenges, and identifying permitting and any data gaps. So we will have a suite of fairly robust projects that have support from locals as well as industry, and they'll really be available for folks to look at seriously and further through subsequent efforts.
Thank you very much, Ms. Edelman. Further questions, Senator von Imhoff?
I guess the key is I see a lot of government agencies, the initial slides there of the stakeholders. How many private industries, private developers, how are they being engaged?
Senator, this is Jennifer Edelman, the lead ASTAR coordinator at DNR OPUMP. Senator von Imhoff, through the chair, great question. We are just beginning to identify and map out our scoping. We plan to start within the communities in the North Slope Borough themselves, meeting with community leaders and individuals, residents, and folks who survive within those areas to learn from them what local infrastructure needs they have. Subsequent to speaking to the local communities, we anticipate having a variety of opportunities to engage both industries present on the slope right now, as well as industries who may have a desire to expand to the slope but don't yet have the ability because of these infrastructure challenges. So there will be a series of meetings, working groups, advisory committees, a wide variety of opportunities for folks from industry as well as investment industry to participate in helping us identify these potential projects. And through our economics and socioeconomics team, working with potential funders to be able to pair projects and funders if possible.
Follow up, Senator Von Imhoff.
I appreciate that. I think that the devil's going to be in the details. It's those are great plans. I wish you luck. I hope that you can follow through. It's a lot easier said than done to get the private industries to make it economic and to find the public-private partnerships. But you're on the right track. I wish you luck.
Thank you for filling us in, Ms. Adelman. I actually have heard of several investment groups that are interested in investing in infrastructure in our North Slope, and so I think you'll find a lot of interest there, and I'm looking forward to seeing how this evolves. So with that, thank you very much to the Department of Natural Resources for briefing us on A-STAR. It's an important project for the North Slope and a way that we can partner with the industry without tax credits. So that would be a step forward. So that concludes our meeting. Our next meeting will be Monday, February 12th. The committee will take up Senate Bill 86, that's testimony on the Alaska Railroad, first. Then we're going to take up the first hearing on Senate Bill 173, related to pesticides and utility poles. That should be captivating. And finally, if there's time, we'll hear a second hearing on Senate Bill 92, which relates to derelict vessels. So with that, we stand adjourned. The time is 5:06 p.m.